It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania are three of the most important states in this year's presidential election. We'll look at a new Wisconsin poll showing the latest on the presidential matchup in all three states. First, Amazon has seen a big boost in sales during the pandemic after spending more than $4 billion to clean warehouses and hire more employees in the last few months. The company's revenue was up 40% from this time last year and had its best quarter ever with record revenue, profits, and growth. This all comes in the middle of an economic downturn and in the midst of an antitrust hearing with CEOs of Apple, Google, Facebook, and Amazon appearing before Congress. Jason Del Rey is a senior correspondent at Recode who has spent the last 7 years reporting on Amazon and the e-commerce industry. He also hosted season one of the tech-focused podcast Land of the Giants, that season called The Rise of Amazon. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this quarterly profit and sales increase huge for Amazon. Can you talk about, you know, this big increase for an already dominant, huge company?
Sure. So, you know, obviously with, you know, a lot of the lockdowns and stay-at-home orders that have sort of proliferated around the country during COVID, a lot of people who did online shopping a good amount before, you know, started doing even more of that. But maybe more importantly, a lot of people who historically have shopped in stores, done grocery shopping in stores, you know, moved some of that spending online. And I think a lot of it will stay there, but even just for the last 3 months, that quarter you talked about, you know, who's going to be one of the biggest recipients of that, you know, new shopping behavior? It's going to be Amazon. They already going into this controlled about 40% of online commerce in the United States. And coming out of this, you know, we don't have the exact figures yet, but it looks like from their record profit and sales, they might have even more of it.
You've written about efforts by other companies to stay in the game, and nobody's been able to do it like Amazon so far. You're looking at the rivalry in a new book you're working on between Walmart and Amazon. Can you talk about what Walmart is trying to do to try to get some of this business away from Amazon?
Sure. So I know for a lot of people it's probably still kind of counterintuitive to think of Walmart as an underdog. Obviously, for decades, you know, especially the 90s and the aughts, they were sort of the, you know, on the vendor side, like the big bad bully of retail. You know, consumers maybe loved their low prices, but suppliers, you know, had rough dealings with them. That's now Amazon. And so, you know, Walmart ignored them for way too long on the digital side. And it's really difficult to disrupt yourself. And so, you know, what they've tried to do over the last few years is really invest a lot in their online business, in new warehouses, and they're really leaning in when it comes to online ordering of grocery. You can pick up groceries curbside at Walmart even before the pandemic, and now they're also ramping up their own grocery delivery. A lot of people may not realize this. Walmart is already the biggest grocer in the U.S., and, you know, so they're trying to sort of fight back, if you will, by really investing a lot in online grocery delivery and just fast delivery of other items, too.
There's a lot of concern lately about some downsides of Amazon. We're going to spend a good chunk of time on that. But can you tell us, Jason, how Amazon captured so much of the consumer market? What did they do right to get us so many of us shopping there?
Sure. So, I mean, it really goes back at least 15 years to the creation of Amazon Prime. Their membership and, you know, what started out as a two-day shipping program is now sort of a, you know, online VIP pass in many ways. It's express shipping, it's video, TV, movie streaming, it's, you know, reading, it's gaming, it's Amazon Music, and, you know, it's just, they're offering, if you use all those services, you're getting way more than your money's worth for that $119 a year. But a lot of people, you know, maybe use a fraction of it, but are still paying that fee. And so it does this psychological thing, too, where, you know, if you know you're paying this $119 a year, you want to get your money's worth, right? So maybe you don't price compare as much as you once might with other websites. You know, maybe you do rely on them for video, a little more than you would have if you didn't have Prime. And so it creates this, what Jeff Bezos called, you know, over a decade ago, like a moat around the company's best customers. And I think that's a huge reason why they've had the success they have.
Talking to Jason Del Rey with Recode. He spent the last 7 years reporting on Amazon. We're looking at Amazon, a big quarter during this pandemic for an already huge dominant player in the retail business. Jason, let's get into some concerns now. One of them came up before a congressional committee, this idea that Amazon is also building a moat around its business model in some ways, the impact it can have on small companies that really don't have any choice but to sell their stuff through Amazon. What kind of concerns are we seeing there?
Yeah, so when it comes to, you know, I think more and more people, consumers realize this now, but maybe not everyone, you know, 60% of the sales that Amazon, you know, executes, it's not Amazon's own inventory that they're stocking. It is the inventory of small and mid-sized, you know, mom-and-pop online merchants. In the industry, they're just called Amazon sellers. And when it comes to the sellers, you know, Amazon will argue, look, they're more than half of our business. They are crucial to our success. You know, we have given them this ability to reach people across the globe. And, you know, we are a big supporter of them. On the seller side, you know, some say, yes, that's true. But Amazon increasingly competes with these sellers, whether it's by Amazon selling their own brands, you know, using some of the data that, you know, they have on these products that sellers sell to compete against them. Other complaints just have to do with it's really hard for these sellers to get someone on the phone at Amazon when they run into an issue. I just got off the phone for a future story with a seller whose account got suspended, and she literally cannot get someone on the phone or an email response. And so, you know, part of the fear is that as Amazon sucks up more of the market share, you either have to play by Amazon's rules or really you cannot have an online retail business. Maybe you can do a little business with Walmart, a little bit with eBay, but really if you want to have any sort of a sustainable business, you need to play with Amazon. And, you know, so there's a whole host of concerns, but those are a couple, you know, of the starting points. Amazon competing against its own sellers and also just not being there when they run into trouble.
And the competing against its own sellers issue could bring up antitrust issues. If I come up with a product and sell it through Amazon and it does pretty well, Amazon knows what my product is. They know who my customers are. They can use their market share there and their access to replace me for all their customers by coming up with their own line of my product. That is kind of classic antitrust issue, right?
It could be. It could indeed be. Amazon's argument will be, listen, you know, this idea of private label goods or a store brand, like that is, you know, that's as old as the modern retail industry. You know, Costco sells Kirkland, hugely successful. Target, you know, sells new brands like Cat and Jack, which is a kids clothing brand. Kroger has their, you know, own store brand. And so Amazon's argument really relies on the fact that, like, this is common practice. Critics and some antitrust critics will say, well, no one has the data that Amazon has. No one has the real-time data. No one has the types of data. So, for example, Amazon can see when someone is about to click on your product and browsing over it, but then decides to go to a different brand. You know, that level, that depth to some people is, you know, makes a difference. The other difference is if you can determine that Amazon has monopoly power over a given sector in retail, you know, that can make behavior that wasn't illegal if they don't have that monopoly power suddenly become illegal. So it gets into the weeds a bit, and I won't go too deep. But there are all these discussions happening in Congress, at the Federal Trade Commission, in antitrust circles, and it's not going away for Amazon right now.
We're talking to Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent at Recode. He's spent the last 7 years reporting on Amazon and e-commerce. He hosted season one of a technology-focused podcast called Land of the Giants, that season called The Rise of Amazon. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a customer, have you been using Amazon more or less over the last few months? A lot of people clearly using it more than they had previously. Are you concerned about Amazon's increased profits and power in the retail market? Do you or have you ever worked for Amazon? Good experience, bad experience, little of both? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Jason Del Rey, senior correspondent at Recode. We're talking about Amazon news in recent months, big sales there during the pandemic, a big hearing before Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Amazon, people say it's really convenient. Do you use it a lot? Have you increased your use of it in the last few months or tried buying stuff there for the first time during the pandemic? What are your thoughts on this big company having such a big part of the retail market? Do you avoid it? And have you worked there ever? What do you think about it from the insider point of view? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And we heard from some of you on Facebook. Gerald says he tries to avoid Amazon whenever possible. He says they exploit their workers and the areas in which they operate. Jason, let's get into that issue of working for Amazon. There's been a lot of back and forth on this. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's to me, it's a nuanced and complex, you know, issue. On one hand, there is the argument, and I see some of it, which is Amazon's pay at their warehouses, the benefits they offer, and from day one for full-time employees, you know, no waiting, no probation, and sort of the, at least the appearance of a path, if you work there and you do well, to sort of rise up. I understand why that is appealing and why they can at times say with a straight face, you know, we think we're doing the best of any of our peers when it comes to hiring and treatment of our employees. Also, they are the second largest private sector employer in the U.S. now, only after, surprise, Walmart. The flip side is, you know, there are obviously tons of anecdotes over the years of tough working conditions, the quotas they require. You know, there are people who believe Amazon will, when they can, automate the entire warehousing experience, and until then, they will push their employees with severe quotas to the point that they're almost, you know, robot-like. That's the flip side. That is, you know, you may pay great for the type of work it is for the areas of the country where, you know, where people are trying to find work. The benefits may also be great, but are the trade-offs worth it when it comes to, you know, reports of higher injury rates or this sort of, you know, not being able to catch your breath? And so, you know, there are different parts of the country for different people. The definition of a good job, I suppose, is different. And so that's what I mean by, you know, it's a nuanced topic.
The pandemic has driven a lot of sales Amazon's way. It's also raised concerns, though, like many workplaces, over worker safety and trying to keep spreading COVID-19 to workers and their communities. What have you seen about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, Amazon, again, they employ hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. And so, you know, some of we did a three-month investigation talking to dozens of employees about some of this labor crisis they faced. Essentially, you know, in different warehouses around the country, you had certain sort of segments of the workforce that said Amazon was either not doing enough in the way of making the warehouses safe during COVID, or that the execution of their new policies, their new, you know, arrangements for social distancing were just not carried out consistently because of the size of their network. And so people were just saying, you know, great, you gave us extra pay for a few months, but then you took that pay away. Great, you gave us unlimited unpaid time off, but then you took that away. You know, the pandemic has not gone away in the U.S., you know, if you look around anywhere. So why have these extra benefits been taken away? And so, you know, Amazon will say, yeah, when it comes to the extra benefits, you know, these were thank you payments. These weren't, this wasn't hazard pay. And I guess on the point of infection rates inside the warehouses, you know, Amazon has not stated how many people have been infected. They have not given specifics on the infection rates, you know, the percentages. What they had been saying was, we are seeing lower infection rates in our facilities than the surrounding communities, but with no information to back that up. Recently, a report came out that at least in Minnesota, the infection rate at one facility based on documentation was actually four times that of the community around them. And so then it's tough to take, you know, the company's PR statements at face value. This saga is not over, but it's been sort of this, you know, back and forth thing between Amazon management and labor organizations and some of their own employees over the last few months.
Talking to Jason Del Rey about the rise of Amazon and how it's dealing with concerns over accusations, anyway, of monopoly power, concerns about workers and their treatment at the warehouses in particular. A lot of you have weighed in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you'd like to share your thoughts with your voice, you can call it at 800-642-1234. Jason Catherine wrote us. She said, I am using local shops. In fact, my Amazon usage has decreased during the pandemic and will continue in this direction. Do you see an undercurrent of backlash of people wanting to avoid Amazon and shop in, as Catherine does, local stores when possible?
I definitely hear that when I talk to readers and I talk to, we've done some reader surveys over the last few months. You definitely hear anecdotes of that. I know my household, we are in many ways still an Amazon Prime household in addition to some of the other big retailers, but there is this feeling of wanting to support your local hardware store, your local restaurants. The problem is, you know, the data, and the data being Amazon's financial data that they release every 3 months, just does not show that there's any sort of mass sustained movement away from them. And, you know, even when you talk to critics of the company, you know, they say, listen, a consumer boycott of Amazon, if you feel they need to change, like, that's not really fair to ask of, you know, the everyday person. Like, we're just trying to get by. You know, we are looking for convenience, best prices. Like, if something's wrong with the way Amazon operates, it's up to government. It's up to, you know, elected officials and or regulators to step in. And so that's sort of, you know, the story that I've been following for the last year, and one I think may stretch into the next couple of years to figure out if Amazon is forced to change how they operate.
But, and as you've written, I think, Jason, if it looks like Amazon is providing good service and value to consumers, is there that motivation for lawmakers or regulators or whoever to step in and change anything?
Well, that's the big question. You know, for decades now, sort of the antitrust, the way that antitrust laws have basically been looked at by government officials is that if the consumer seems to be benefiting by a company's service or practices, you know, there hasn't been a real desire to step in. And so just over the last few years, there's been this sort of legal movement in legal and antitrust circles to look at the antitrust laws in a sort of slightly different, more competition-focused way. The other thing I should just note is there are some, you know, people who argue that Amazon's practices actually may help keep consumer prices up because of how many fees they charge to Amazon sellers and the fact that they penalize sellers in many cases if they sell goods cheaper on other websites. So I don't know if that argument will sort of take hold in any of these government investigations, but those arguments are out there.
Another side of antitrust law that people point to sometimes is that, well, okay, if this business is keeping competitors from gaining a foothold in the market, preventing them from innovating in ways that maybe not today or tomorrow, but in a few years might benefit the consumers, that might be cause for antitrust regulators to step in. Is that something that's being talked about?
Definitely. You know, I forget which lawmaker, but in the congressional hearing you spoke of, you know, someone referenced what they called, you know, an innovation kill zone that these tech giants operate in. You know, essentially, you know, their power to either clone or acquire anyone who sort of poses a serious threat. You know, the examples used with Amazon, you know, these are going back now about a decade, but Amazon buying a company that owned diapers.com back about 9-10 years ago, and even before that, Amazon buying Zappos, which is now over a decade ago, that acquisition. And the idea that, you know, Amazon has the resources to cut prices to make life really hard for these growing, you know, more independent businesses, until the point that they can either, you know, dismiss them through running them out of business or just buy them up. And so, yes, that is, there were many questions about that in the congressional hearing, some email documentation talking about internal talks about these types of acquisitions. And so that's something I'm keeping an eye on for sure.
And just under our last minute, Jason, what are you watching for next in the Amazon saga?
Yeah, I am the congressional investigation, the group, the 15 members who have been investigating the tech giants over the last year, they're releasing a congressional report probably sometime in September or October. They will have recommendations, whether that means recommendations on new antitrust law, recommendations to regulators on how they think they maybe should act. That is sort of the next step to see whether there's any teeth to these investigations. You know, the big what if is, you know, what the presidential election will bring and how that may influence these agencies investigating Amazon and the others. So that is what I'm looking for, this report in the next 2 months.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jason Del Rey is a senior correspondent at Recode. He has been reporting on Amazon and e-commerce for years. He's working on a book right now about Amazon versus Walmart. Coming up after the news, we'll find out what a new poll from UW's Elections Research Center shows about the presidential race in three key swing states, including, yes, Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are several missions to Mars this summer. We'll talk about some of their goals and some of the mysteries that still hold our attention on the red planet. First, the presidential election is less than 3 months away, and three swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, are still some of the most closely watched in the country. A new poll from UW-Madison's Elections Research Center and the Wisconsin State Journal surveyed 800 registered voters in each of those states, conducted between July 27th and August 6th, that asked people not only who they plan to vote for, but also how events like the coronavirus pandemic and protests against racial injustice affect their choices. Barry Burden is a political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. Barry, good to have you back with us.
Hey, good afternoon.
Before we look at some of the numbers, let's talk about the importance of these states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and why you're focusing on them.
Well, these are the three states that were the difference makers in 2016. All three of them were thought to be part of a kind of blue wall that would protect Democratic candidates in all subsequent elections. But all three, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, flipped to Trump in 2016. And by very small margins, the three states together only gave Trump a margin of 77,000 votes. But that ended up making the difference in his victory in the Electoral College.
All right, let's get to these new numbers you have from your survey. What do we see in the three states?
In the head-to-head matchup between Biden and Trump, if the election were today, Biden would be in a strong position in all three states. We have him up in Wisconsin, 49-43, so a 6-point margin among registered voters here. Up by a bigger margin in Pennsylvania, 50-41, so that's a 9-point lead. And in Michigan, a somewhat smaller lead at 47-43. So right now, Trump is behind in the three states that he really would like to win again in order to win again in 2020.
as you mentioned, you're talking about registered voters here. I understand you also asked, how likely are you to vote? What did you find when you looked at people who expressed the greatest willingness, the greatest certainty that they'd go to the polls?
Yeah, it is always a challenge to figure out exactly who will vote on election day. That makes election polling different than other kinds of surveys. And particularly in the pandemic, I think we have some uncertainty about who will be voting in November. So we asked only of those who said they were absolutely certain to vote in November what their vote breakdown would be. And in every case, Biden's margin over Trump was actually larger. So in Wisconsin, it went from 49-43 among just the registered voters to a bigger lead of 52-44, an 8-point lead. And in all three states, Biden had a clear majority of the vote, so at least 50% of the vote. Obviously puts him in a very strong position.
Now, I know there's the usual asterisk. We're a few months out from the election. Things can change. But people might also be thinking, hey, wait a minute, what about 2016? So the national polls, they got the popular vote margin. They did pretty good. But in states like Wisconsin, the polls running up to the elections and the outcome, they looked a little different than each other. So how do you factor that in?
Well, we do need to let the fall campaign play out, and there are lots of things yet to happen, including debates, selection of Biden's running mate, the two conventions, and whatever happens with the pandemic and the economy. But I think there are two things that make us more confident about the polls this time around. One is that some of the liabilities of polls 4 years ago have been fixed. In particular, a number of surveys did not interview enough people with lower levels of education. They were skewed towards college graduates. And those voters were predominantly Clinton voters. And so there was an undersampling of Trump supporters. Most good survey houses now have explicitly controlled for that. And that happens in our survey as well. In all three of our states, we have an exact representation of the educational breakdown in each state. So that's not a concern this time around. The other difference this year is that the national polls and the state polls are telling the same story. And 4 years ago, they were not. The national polls were showing a small Clinton lead, which is where she ended up, so they were quite accurate. But the state polls, especially in Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, were showing Clinton with bigger leads that didn't quite square with the national story, especially because these states are bellwether states that should be close to the national vote. This year around, everything is in agreement for the most part. National polls show Biden with a lead of 6 or 7 or 8 points, depending on the day and the poll. State polls are showing similar leads in these battlegrounds that are near the tipping point. So the consistency of those two levels of surveys and the durability, it's now been many weeks with these very sizable Biden leads, makes me more comfortable that Biden actually is ahead of Trump. Again, at this point, it's a snapshot. It's not election day. But where we are today, I think the polls should give you a high level of confidence about Trump's troubles at the moment.
Talking to Barry Burden, political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center, about a new poll looking at three battleground states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, showing a lead for Joe Biden over Donald Trump in all three states. What has changed since that 2016 election? Do we know who is moving, inching over toward the Democratic side of the ticket or of the ballot this year?
Well, one important group are whites. And in Wisconsin, that is the bulk of the electorate. This is a pretty white state, and white voters, even small shifts in that group, can have big consequences for the election. Donald Trump won whites, if you believe the exit polls, by about 9 percentage points over Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin. And even in prior elections, typically the Republican, whether it's Mitt Romney or John McCain, would win the white vote in Wisconsin and then lose the non-white vote. But right now, our surveys are showing the white vote's very competitive. Whites are pretty evenly divided in Wisconsin and the other two states between Biden and Trump. And if that holds until Election Day, Trump will be in great trouble because he's sure to lose the black vote by a very large margin and the Hispanic and the other non-white votes by a sizable margin as well. So he is going to need to pull back some of those white voters who are now at least toying with the idea of voting for Joe Biden.
Let's get into some of the issues you asked voters about. One of them, the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and the president's handling of it. How did that factor into your results?
Well, we did ask people who they put the blame on for the spread of the virus. So not its origin, but why the pandemic was happening. And the largest number of voters fingered Donald Trump for that. It was about 40%. thought that he was and his administration were primarily responsible. There was a sizable group that pointed to China as the culprit or to other public officials, maybe Congress, public health agencies like the CDC. But opinion about those was more divided. And I think the public was more focused on the administration and Donald Trump as being a key player in the spread of the virus. And that has clearly brought down his approval ratings, which were already not great. He had been underwater in this state and nationally for a while. And those ratings have lowered even further since about early April.
We've also seen, of course, a lot of protests about racial injustice over the last couple of months. You asked about that. What did you hear from voters?
We did. The survey asked the public whether they were satisfied or dissatisfied with how Trump has handled those protests. And in all three states, a majority said they were dissatisfied with his handling. Again, this is not opinions about the protests themselves, but about how Trump has responded. In particular, I think the sending of troops into Portland, Oregon, and the way that Lafayette Square was cleared for a promotional event there some weeks ago. The public is divided. They're not of one mind, but on balance, they are more unhappy than happy with how he has handled things.
I want to compare the three different states now. You write that Wisconsin, compared to Michigan and Pennsylvania, looks a little different in terms of the makeup of our electorate. What makes us special here?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are leads for Biden in all three states, but for different reasons. In Michigan and Pennsylvania, the lead is mainly because there are more Democrats there. And in all three states, Democrats are very unified in voting for Biden, Republicans equivalently unified in voting for Trump, but Democrats simply outnumber Republicans in those states. That's not true in Wisconsin, where Republicans and Democrats are basically equal in size. They balance one another remarkably well, and they are equally unified, so their votes sort of cancel out. And so the difference maker in Wisconsin are independents, who in our survey are going for Biden 54 to 37, so a pretty sizable margin of somewhere between 15 and 20 points on Biden's side. That's not what's happening in the other states, where independents are more equally balanced. So there is maybe a different opportunity for Trump here if he can win back some of those independents. It's going to be maybe more of a challenge for him in Michigan and Pennsylvania, where he would probably need to pull some Democrats over to his side.
Looking back at 2016 again, we saw a small but significant number of people go to third-party candidates. Do you have any sense, based on your polling or other information out there, on whether we're likely to see that again in 2020?
Well, it does look like there'll be some independent or third-party candidates on the ballot in Wisconsin. Right now, a very small percentage of people are indicating that they would vote for a non-major party candidate. I think the Kanye West news about his efforts to get on the ballot was just developing as our survey was in the field, so that may not be fully realized here. But it's almost certain to be a smaller share of voters who go for third parties this time than 4 years ago. And that will, I think, complicate things for Trump. He did not manage to win a majority of the vote, so 50% of the vote, in any of these states. And without third parties in the mix in a significant way, he will probably need to do that to win the popular vote in all three places.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Barry Burton is a political science professor at UW-Madison and director of the Elections Research Center. He talked to us about the center's latest battleground state poll, which shows Joe Biden with a lead over President Trump in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Coming up, the U.S. isn't the only nation heading to Mars this summer. We'll look at who else is going and what they're hoping to learn. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, this year's presidential nominating conventions will be a lot smaller scale than originally planned, but they will include party platforms in one form or another. A politics expert tells us what goes into those platforms and whether they still matter. First, the U.S. has another rover on its way to Mars. It follows recent launches by China and the United Arab Emirates. Mars is the most studied planet that isn't called Earth, but there are still a lot of mysteries left to answer. A lot of them have to do with life on Mars. Was there ever any? Could it have supported life in the past? And does it have what it takes to host life forms in the future? Answers to those questions could tell us a lot about the origins of life here on Earth. Science writer Becky Ferreira contributed to a New York Times series on Mars to coincide with the various missions. Becky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
you focus in your piece, Becky, on life on Mars. We'll get into some of the questions about that. But as you look at these various probes, whether they're landing on Mars or in orbit, is that a big part of the questions they're trying to answer? Mysteries of, you know, habitability of Mars?
Yes, absolutely. The Perseverance rover is the first operational surface robot on Mars since the Viking era that is actually really designed to go and look for past life, mostly of Mars. So that's very exciting. China's rover as well is supposed to be looking into some habitability questions. And the third mission, the United Arab Emirates one, I think is focusing mostly on the weather on Mars, which, of course, you know, is a great part of the picture of the planet as a whole. But it's an orbiter, so it won't be having that kind of close surface look.
Mars doesn't look too lively right now, but you write that there's a lot of thought that maybe back in the day, and that day was a long time ago, things might have looked better. What are some of the thoughts on what Mars might have looked like and why it might have been a candidate anyway to support life?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's fascinating to think about Mars and it when it was probably habitable. I mean, most scientists do think about 4 billion years ago, it had all the right conditions for life. There was clearly a lot of liquid water on the surface. How long that liquid water lasted is not clear, but you know, you can look at the site that Perseverance is headed towards, which is called Jezero Crater. I honestly always recommend people just Google that because you can see clearly a river delta there. It's unmistakably the same kind of features you would see on Earth. So there's definitely a lot of evidence that huge swaths of the planet were covered in water. And, you know, there's also Curiosity, the rover that preceded Perseverance, has uncovered a lot of evidence for organic materials in its little ancient lake bed that it's been exploring. So those are some really tantalizing kind of little tidbits. And it's possible, although debated, that there was at one point quite a large ocean on the northern lowlands of Mars as well. So that is pretty exciting to look into.
And this is a huge thing, right? Because life, at least as we Earthlings understand it, you just about got to have water for there to be the prospect for life, right?
It is the number one thing people look for. I mean, water is very essential to all of the kind of metabolic reactions and chemical reactions that we need as life forms. It's what we look for when we look at exoplanets orbiting other stars. That is the number one thing that they that makes an exoplanet considered in the habitable zone is if it can support liquid water.
Okay, so if I'm a rover rolling around on Mars, what am I looking for? What are the signs I'm looking for to see whether there was life-supporting material on Mars or even signs of past life on Mars?
Oh, it's such a great question. And I'm sure that, you know, it would be great to kind of have an immediate biomarker that was very clearly like a, you know, a fossil of some great beast. But I think it's going to be quite debated, even if something very tantalizing is found. One example of something that Dr. Ken Farley, who's the project scientist of Mars, told me for my New York Times article, is this idea of stromatolites, which are found on Earth. They're some of the oldest formations from life ever found. They're billions of years old. And, you know, him and his team had gone out to see these stromatolites in Australia. And he was really kind of taken aback by how obvious it was that this was something special. So those types of things that it's not necessarily that we're going to find like stromatolites necessarily, but we have examples of what very, very simple microbial creatures could accomplish in the earliest days of Earth's history. And those are the types of things that the Perseverance scientists are hoping to see, especially in sort of the shoreline area of where the new rover is going. It's also, this rover is going to be taking a number of drill cores that it will be leaving for a future rover to try to send back to Earth. So it's part of a sort of trilogy of missions in that way. So hopefully, if we do get those samples back, I mean, that would be just amazing. It would be the first time we had actual samples to look at from Mars that were prepared in that way and that weren't just meteorites that came to, luckily, to Earth. So there could be maybe some interesting signs of microbial activity in there as well.
Talking to science writer Becky Ferreira about a piece she wrote for The New York Times looking at the past, present, and future of the potential for Mars to support life. Becky, another question you point out there is, okay, if Mars billions of years ago looked like a pretty good candidate to support life, what happened?
Yeah, it definitely makes you feel lucky to be an Earthling when you look at Mars's history. So one of the biggest things that happened and that is still quite mysterious is that Mars's magnetic field just kind of kicked out within the first billion years of its lifetime. And here on Earth, we are very lucky to have a nice, robust magnetic field, which keeps us safe from the solar wind stream of charged particles that the sun emits. That's quite, you know, makes life inhospitable. It kind of irradiates the surface of a planet. So basically, soon after Mars's magnetic, you know, mojo kind of got kicked out, it began to lose its atmosphere, and that basically has led to it being fairly dried up, irradiated at the surface, extremely cold at the surface. So a very inert planet for at least about 3 billion years.
If we found current life on Mars, it sounds like it's probably not going to be at the surface. What is the thinking on whether there could be something still around way down underground?
I am so holding out for that possibility. So, yeah, so it is a very inhospitable on the surface. But there are these kind of tantalizing signs that something interesting is going on. Whether it's life producing that is a matter of much debate. But we're getting, Curiosity has noticed that there are these kind of spikes of methane that come up through Mars. And it's one of the only kind of surface probes that's been able to detect those. So that could be any number of geological processes that produce methane naturally. But on Earth, methane is also produced by these very hardy microbes. And so there is some thinking that perhaps deep in sort of subterranean reservoirs of Mars, we know that there is some water very, very deep beyond the access of any surface probe that potentially could be life forms that have managed to make it through in some way. So that's really interesting. Not sure how exactly we would be able to access those kinds of places, but it certainly is a mystery that I think a lot of these new missions will be looking into.
A big part of the story here is learning about Mars, of course, but you write that a lot of people are thinking what we learn on Mars could tell us something about what has happened and the origins of life here on Earth. How so?
Well, exactly, because Mars has, you know, it's sad that it's if you're a person who really wants to find extraterrestrial life, it's sad that it appears to be quite dead now. But the upside of that is that nothing has really changed a lot. I mean, there's been asteroid impacts, occasional volcanic explosions and things like that on Mars, but it's basically what you see is what it was billions of years ago. So if you want to kind of understand what the early Earth was like, Mars is great to explore. It's a kind of analog for that. And Earth, by contrast, one of the biggest reasons that we can't, we have so much trouble kind of finding out how life originated here is that there just really aren't that many signs that are left, because Earth is constantly, you know, life is all over the surface of the Earth. It's constantly has plate tectonics and atmospheric shifts and all of these things that just like reinvent itself all the time. So there's not a huge record the way that there is where you just land on Mars and it's like, okay, this is, you know, this is immediately what it would have looked like so long ago. So that's a really, really interesting point too.
In our last minute or so, Becky, we've got to wait, of course, for the newest probes to head to Mars. What piece of information are you most excited to hear back as they land, as results come out?
Oh, gosh. I mean, first of all, fingers crossed, and I hope everyone, you know, tries to send good luck to these probes. It's very hard to land on Mars, despite the fact that NASA's done it so many times. It's still, you know, quite a challenge. And if China accomplishes landing their rover, that will be the first time any other country has done it. So I think, honestly, obviously, it would be the best thing ever to have some kind of evidence of past life. But what I think is really cool, too, about these new missions is the kind of international scope of them. And I hope to see that whatever are the discoveries that are made, unexpected or whatever, I hope that there's a lot more collaboration going forward in terms of planetary exploration, because I think it's very exciting to see new nations heading out to other planets. And so hopefully it'll spur a collaborative kind of a spirit.
Becky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
I've been talking to Becky Ferreira, a science writer. We talked with her about her recent piece looking at the mysteries of life on Mars that appeared in the New York Times under the title Three Great Mysteries About Life on Mars, part of a series at the Times looking at some of the big questions about the red planet as three countries have various kinds of probes on the way, the United States, China, and the United Arab Emirates. If you have a space question you'd like us to tackle in the future here on Central Time, email ideas@WPR.org. On Food Friday last week, we asked how your cooking has changed during the pandemic. You shared a lot of great stories and ideas. Thanks for that. We also asked around at Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. We shared some stories on Friday from our colleagues. Here are a few more that we didn't get to. Morgan Stewart in the Wisconsin Public Media Director's Office says, to my surprise and my husband's, I've been making big batches of deviled eggs during the pandemic, and I absolutely love them. Morgan says they're unexpectedly refreshing, messy, tangy, spicy, protein-rich comfort food. My last batch included a couple of cherry tomato halves on top for a splash of color. The natural acidity cuts the richness of the yolky batter. Such a strange food for a person to fall in love with, but hey, I'm taking whatever comfort I can get these days. Not so strange. I never think about deviled eggs except when they're there, and I love them. I can't get enough of them. So, I definitely respect that choice. Cheryl Gasser, the Ideas Network director, says, tacos, tacos, tacos. We make them at least once a week. They're quick and easy, but also delicious. They're a familiar favorite in our house. We try to mix up the toppings with whatever vegetables are in season, like radish, zucchini, or fresh corn. And Sarah Jacobs, membership director at Wisconsin Public Radio, says, my dad's South Indian salmon curry is one of my most grounding comfort foods. I've had the recipe, she says, for many years, always been too intimidated to make it. And she says, calling my dad to vet the steps gave us both something enjoyable to connect on. You can share your pandemic cooking changes and favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.